Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Coutillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased to have with us Dr. Daniel Larson. Dr. Larson is a college lecturer in history at Trinity College, Cambridge, and today we are discussing his book, Plotting Peace, American Peacemakers, British Codebreakers, and Britain at War, 1914 to 1917. Published by Cambridge University Press. Welcome, Dr. Larson.
Welcome. Yes, hello. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Larson, what would you say is the thesis of your book?
So the main argument is about Britain and America in the First World War. The main argument is that there was a key faction in the British government that took American peace diplomacy much more seriously than people have recognized in 1916 in particular. And it traces why they were interested, which was mainly out of economic reasons, and then why these efforts failed to come to fruition in terms of looking at the intelligence dimension and the division in British politics. So it looks at American diplomacy and the British war effort is the main focus of the book.
How would you say that your book challenges the existing historiographical consensus on the subject area covered by the book?
So the existing historiography is pretty united in the assumption that the British leadership never had any interest in American efforts to mediate the First World War. That Colonel House, who was the kind of the figurehead or the head of these efforts for the United States side, he was the chief advisor and confidant of U.S. President Woodrow Wilson. That his efforts never went anywhere, and that the only people who were interested or who looked to be interested in American mediation were only pretending to be so for his sake, just humoring him. And my work challenges that. It argues extensive research in British archives shows that. That he was taken much more seriously than people recognize. That the British some of the British leaders were starting to think about wanting to find a way out of the First World War, mainly for economic reasons. That they did not believe that the British war effort was capable of winning the war without the United States.
How and why does your treatment of Woodrow Wilson as peacemaker differ from that of Philip Zelikoff in his recent book, a book which I might add relies heavily on your own?
We have come to rather different conclusions on that front, or at least of the American side. So in my portrayal, Colonel House comes across as quite a competent character who understands what power he has at his disposal and who is able to cultivate a desirably strong diplomatic relationship with the British, while Woodrow Wilson, on the other hand, doesn't really seem to grapple with the realities of British politics and of the realities of the geopolitics of the European war. He sort of leaves the House, and it leads Wilson to make some very serious mistakes, in my view. Whereas Zelikow's treatment is a little bit the other way around, in terms of how he sees these two individuals. But I'll leave the reader to explore that difference, I suppose.
How can, though, your mostly positive view of Colonel House make sense insofar as, he did not have any diplomatic experience at all prior to 1913, 1914. B, he didn't speak any European languages. And C, at times he appears to be almost what Zelikow refers to as either a villain or a fool.
So I think there's a few reasons. First of all, I think in a lot of respects, diplomacy is an extension of the kinds of personal politics the House was involved in before the First World War and had spent his entire life cultivating in terms of understanding networks of people and understanding networks of politics. I mean, I think the applying that to the international stage, House has a little bit of a learning curve. But despite that learning curve, like that kind of expertise in the politics personal relations is something that he does very well. And he does very well in kind of cultivating a really serious trust on the part of Sir Edward Grey in particular. And I don't think that the presentation of him as a fool really stands up to scrutiny in light of the receptive British response to his diplomacy. That presentation makes sense when the view of House is that his diplomacy is going nowhere. But actually, the American peace diplomacy requires for it to succeed on the part of the British requires a very serious level of trust between Britain and the United States. That it requires the British to believe that Wilson will actually deliver, that the Americans will deliver on the promises that they make in the form of the House Grey Memorandum, in which the United States secretly promises a set of minimum peace terms. And for House to secure that trust on the part of a number of British leaders, I think reflects a much more serious diplomatist than others have given House credit for.
Now, your view of the relationship between Colonel House and Sir Edward Grey relies heavily on the Trevelyan biography. And while you were writing the book, because it's not in the bibliography, came out Thomas Otte's, what widely regarded as definitive biography, now on Sir Edward Grey. Now, Otte has a somewhat different a view of the Grey-House relationship. For the most part, he says that he can't make out whether or not Grey regarded House as a genuine friend, and that for the most part, he has the impression that Grey's primarily interested in manipulating House for purposes of UK diplomacy. Mm-hmm. Do you still adhere to the Trevelyan view?
So I wouldn't say that it rests on Trevelyan's view. I would say that actually there are a lot of documents from a lot of various archives, in particular Charles Harding's papers at, just here at the University of Cambridge Library, discuss Harding's rather disgust at the extent to which Gray trusts House, as reflected also in the Barkey papers in London. And so I think I have compiled a sufficient number of quotations from across British archives that show other people within the British government horror at the extent to which, or his opponents within the British government horror at his trust of House, that if Gray was feigning or was just humoring House, that he would have no reason, there would be no reason to find all these quotations in various British documents. So certainly I hold to the view that Gray trusted and had a very favorable opinion of House. In fact, if you look at some of the correspondence between the two after both are no longer relevant on the political scene, there's a real degree of genuine warmth in this that I think reflects the bond that had been created in 1915 and 1916. So I very much adhere to the view that this was a genuine and warm relationship.
Now, if the hero of Zelikow's book was Bethmann Hollweg, the German chancellor, the hero of your book, correct me if I'm wrong, would be, if the book had to have a hero, would be Reginald McKenna, who was, for most of the book, the Chancellor of the Exchequer in succession to Lloyd George. Would that be a correct assessment of your opinion of McKenna?
I wouldn't go so far as to say hero, but I do think McKenna and Asquith in particular have been sort of overly harshly treated by history, and that a more careful assessment reveals a more positive portrayal. So I shy away from the word hero, but otherwise, sure. Yes, it's a reasonably positive portrayal of Reginald McKenna and Herbert Asquith as British leaders.
Now, would you agree with the assessment that, at least of some historians, that one of the reasons, not the only one by any means, but one of the reasons why Asquith promoted McKenna to such high posts as Chancellor, Home Secretary, First Lord of the Admiralty, was the fact that Asquith enjoyed, for lack of a better expression, une amitié amoureuse with McKenna's wife?
This relationship arises a bit later on. I forget exactly when this begins, but it's nearer to the start of the First World War. It's an interesting relationship. I've been through the letters he exchanges with Pamela McKenna at the which are at Churchill College here in Cambridge, it's not quite clear exactly what the relationship or the setup is between these two three people. I mean, I think Martin Farr, who is an excellent scholar on Reginald McKenna, makes a convincing case that McKenna is aware of the correspondence going between the Prime Minister and his wife, and so it's not quite clear exactly what's going on. But I think the relationship between Asquith and McKenna stems much more from a political bond rather than this kind of complicated personal relationship that's a little more difficult to work out.
Now, why do you have a higher opinion of McKenna as Chancellor of the Exchequer than Lloyd George, who was his predecessor?
A lot of it stems... The focus of the book, the two have various merits on various issues, but the focus of the book is on Britain's economic relationship with the United States, which is of crucial importance. And Reginald McKenna understands this relationship, whereas Lloyd George simply doesn't, because the key problem facing British finance and the Anglo-American economic relationship is the huge dependence of the British government on the British and Allied war effort on American goods and American supplies, and an inability to secure proper financing for these in the United States, that Americans simply won't lend the funds necessary to sustain this supply line. And so the British are trying to sustain this supply line through liquidation of assets. But the problem with this is that you only have so many assets that you can liquidate before they're gone. And Reginald McKenna understands this problem, that he sees that these American supplies are operating on a time limit. I believe I show in the book that Reginald McKenna is right on this point, that the British war effort, they either have to get the United States into the war by early to mid-1917, or they have to figure out a completely different way of fighting the First World War that doesn't rely on these American supplies, or they have to bring the First World War to an end. And Lloyd George simply refuses to come to grapple with this reality. He consistently believes that basically Britain is financially invulnerable, and that this isn't a real problem, I judge him pretty harshly for this simple refusal to come to grips with the reality of the situation.
So actually, in the book, there's a division in the British government between what you refer to as realist versus maximalist. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so the realists are basically the people who understand this problem, that these American supplies are limited. And as I put it, the strategic decision facing the British government in the winter of 1915 and 1916 is they have a choice a long war, vast amounts of American supplies, or a massive British war effort, choose any two, is how I put it. And the realists come to grips with it. They understand that either they can rely on these supplies, have a big British war effort, which is what they decide to do, but it comes with the trade-off that these supplies are not going to last very long, and that they only have a finite window in which to make this great big effort. On the other hand, the maximalists are people who refuse to come to grips with this reality. They insist on a maximal British war effort, so maximum American supplies, maximum British deployment, British war effort, while believing that these can be sustained indefinitely. And I argue that they're wrong, that the British government did not have the ability to fight the kind of war effort that they demanded.
Now, what was the House Grey Memorandum, and why was not activated by the British in 1916?
Yes. So the House Grey Memorandum is an agreement that House and Grey concluded in February of 1916, in which the Americans promised that they would secure a kind of minimum compromise set of peace terms for the Allies at a peace conference, if the Allies agreed to support such a conference, and that the United States would attempt to leverage its power against Germany, and that if Germany refused to come to this conference, the United States would threaten them with war in order to bring them into conference, and that the United States would threaten Germany with war if it did not accept this set of minimum peace terms. The reasons why it doesn't get activated are multiple. Some stem from mistakes on the part of President Wilson, who unintentionally undermines the foundations of the agreement in a public speech in May of 1916. Some of it has to do with this internal debate between these two different sides in the British government, one of whom doesn't see any reason to bring in the Americans because they refuse to accept the kind of strategic calculus that's driving the other side to believe that the Housegrave Memorandum ought to be implemented. So there's a lot of very complex politics and diplomacy that goes into it. But I think those are kind of the two central factors at play.
Why did the cabinet decide to rely upon the Somme offensive to deliver, in the words of Lloyd George, quote, the knockout blow, unquote?
A lot of it has to do with the politics of the internal politics of the British government, which is evenly divided between liberals and conservatives. The liberals, by and large, tend to be a bit more skeptical about this, the ability of this offensive to produce results. And as the liberals tend to be the realists, they're also much more anxious about the consequences of a failure on the Somme, that they recognize that their strategy is one of, as I sometimes refer to it, as Battle of the Somme or bust, that they either have to win the war with the Battle of the Somme or that the war is going potentially to be over as a consequence of not being able to rely on the U.S. as their source of supplies. Whereas the conservatives, who not all of them, but by and large tend to be maximalists, first have a great deal more confidence in Battle of the Somme to produce results, a higher level of trust in the military leadership, and then secondly, a disbelieving of the necessity to win the war with the Battle of the Somme, that it's perfectly fine for the Battle of the Somme to produce sort of middling to positive results in the expectation that fresh offensives can be run on the same kind of basis in the subsequent year.
Why were such intelligent and sophisticated diplomats like Lords Hardinge and Bertie so violently opposed to American mediation?
Part of it comes from the strategic calculus that Hardinge is much more willing to say that at one point he says that the Battle of the Somme has produced good results and we look forward to continuing on the struggle next year to something like that, and so he doesn't accept this strategic calculus and so sees no reason to bring in the Americans is a large part of it. A second part of it is a kind of reflexive hostility to the Americans. Part of which perhaps stems from the fact that they never got to know Colonel House very well. That Colonel House didn't cultivate them because Hardinge was not yet in post and Bertie was not yet. And Bertie was just simply not someone who he had seen very much of in Paris. And so I think some of it reflects the kind of hostility towards this person that they do not know and have no reason to trust. And And then combined with that is the U.S. presidential election in 1916, which adds to a sense that perhaps House is only over here for domestic political reasons, and that Bertie at one point talks about Wilson being affected by the at several points as Wilson being driven by the presidential election and by nothing else, even though that's completely untrue. So I think that sums it up pretty well.
Why was the conscription crisis of 1916 so important in terms of domestic and indeed other aspects of British policy and politics?
So the conscription crisis is sort of at the center of this British strategic debate. So the question is Britain going to mount an all-out war effort in 1916, or is it going to hold back a bit and concentrate a bit more on sustaining this American supply link? And the question with conscription is basically, conscription is what's needed in order to produce the men for the all-out war effort. And so conscription is a kind of proxy debate for this much larger strategic debate. Which plays out over the winter of 1916, and that's why the issue of conscription is so important. It's because the debate over it is really a debate not over the niceties of whether it's appropriate to bring people by force into the to compel people into the armed forces, but it's really a debate over the United States and about what kind of British war effort is going to be fought in 1916 and how long. A British war effort that relies on the United States as its base of supplies could last.
Why do you regard the German mediation efforts of 1916 and early 1917 as not being entirely serious or only serious insofar as such mediation efforts would result in the German victory?
Yes, because I think it's clear that the kinds of proposals that Germany makes are aimed at securing a kind of victory by negotiation. That the kinds of terms that Germany suggests that it's willing to accept are the terms of potentially a more moderate German victory than Germany aimed at earlier in the war before the autumn of 1916. But there's still terms that reflect a German victory, which reflects the situation on the ground. And Germany has made significant territorial advances throughout Belgium, into France, into Russia. They and their allies have a significant military advantage in southeastern Europe. And so on the basis of what we see in German diplomacy in late 1916, the kind of peace that Germany is aiming at appears to be a kind of victory by negotiation, which differs pretty considerably from the kind of closer to a kind of genuine compromise. That's reflected in what the British liberals are interested in and what the Americans hope to achieve.
How and why did Lloyd George manage to oust Asquith in December 1916 from the premiership?
Ah, yes. This is it's a fascinating series of events. So it's a fairly complex political crisis that involves a lot of brinksmanship by Lloyd George and a fair few mistakes by Asquith. The circumstances at the beginning of December or the end of November of 1916 is actually one in which Lloyd George has been outmaneuvered and is isolated, that there's no appetite for replacing Asquith, or not much of one, amongst the Conservatives, rank and file, in the cabinet, and And yet Lloyd George kicks off the crisis with a really dramatic threat that he is going to not only resign from the government, but he is going to stomp across the country, delivering hostile speeches, attempting to force the collapse of the Asquith coalition. And it's this threat that sets the circumstances for the next few days. The Conservatives decide that Lloyd George cannot be allowed to make this threat, and that to carry out this threat, and that the only thing that's to be done is for Lloyd George to try to form a government. Whether or not he succeeds is another question. And Asquith attempts to make a deal with Lloyd George. According to new documents I found at the University of Oxford that were only put into researchers' availability or researchers' hands over the past handful of years or recent years, Asquith thinks he's succeeded in getting Lloyd George to back down. But on the other hand, to the extent that Asquith thinks this, he's wrong, and Lloyd George leaks very violently against the deal that they supposedly struck, or that Asquith thinks they struck, eventually maneuvers Asquith into a position where Lloyd George resigns from a position of strength, and forces Asquith to resign in a much weaker position, sort of 6 days later, and this position of weakness allows Lloyd George to succeed in forming a government, whereas a few days earlier he might well or probably would have failed to put a government together, and Asquith would have returned to the top role with his position strengthened.
So would it be correct to say that Lloyd George, throughout this period, November, December 1916, was he, in addition to being duplicitous and opportunistic, also manipulating the situation and therefore saw an opportunity come to oust Asquith? Or did he aim from the very beginnings to oust Asquith and he just used what came on his way in terms of opportunities and weapons for that purpose?
Lloyd George was definitely determined to seize power. The form in which this power would take could be up for negotiation, but Lloyd George was determined to seek power. There's about a really good document actually from earlier in 1916 in which Lloyd George talks about trying to force a general election in the middle of the war and then come in and win the general election. So it's clear that Lloyd George really has his eye on the top prize from an early stage, and that this is a matter of personal ambition. Yes, he, in my view, he acts in a very manipulative way throughout the crisis, a brilliant way from a matter of kind of tactical politics, but certainly a very manipulative and duplicitous way in which he tells different people very different things depending on what suits him politically. A master manipulator, but also a brilliant political tactician, how I would describe it.
Now, upon entering number 10 in December 1916, what, au fond, was Lloyd George's opinion, or what did he really think about the UK's chances of winning the war at that point?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Certainly. Upon entering 10 Downing Street in December 1916, what, au fond, was Lloyd George's thinking about the UK's chances of winning the war at that point?
Lloyd George, he comes into office with a very sort of contradictory set of views, in that he thinks that the war effort is going terribly badly, but at the same time, he just recently publicly committed himself to a knockout blow. As one observer put it, that he seems to combine the kind of gloomiest view of the state of the war alongside a really ambitious view of what how the Allies should win the war. And so reconciling these is, I think, possible in that, I mean, I think Lloyd George had a huge amount of confidence in his own abilities and his own ability to kind of set things right. And that he believed that that maybe that the term knockout blow is kind of better understood as a kind of exaggerated metaphor. That Lloyd George believed he could secure a kind of victory, but one that didn't necessarily have to involve Allied troops marching into Berlin. That an Allied victory could take a more limited form, but that it still had to be a form of Allied victory. And so I think that's kind of the best way to understand his view, is that he thinks that Britain's got a lot of time left, that the Allies have a lot of time left if they need it, and so with that time, he can lead the Allies into a kind of favorable position that could be called a victory.
Now, could it not be argued that at bottom, that Wilson's and House's underlying Anglophilia made them extremely reluctant to coerce the Allies, the Entente powers, into entering a peace conference, and that in the absence of any type of real American coercion, the Entente powers would simply refuse to pursue the peace option?
I mean, to an extent. But I think that it's not the absence of coercion against the Allies that's central. It's establishing what it is that Germany wants, and that it's about establishing the way in which these negotiations are going to unfold, such that the Americans could be confident of them resulting in a kind of in a compromise outcome that is a real compromise. And so there's this really illustrative misunderstanding, or perhaps deliberate misunderstanding on the part of the German ambassador to Washington, Count Behrensdorf, in January of 1917, in which he sort of misleads House into thinking that Germany is ready to accept, is ready to make huge concessions, and is ready to accept a genuine, a real compromise as a result of the war. And House leaps at this and is perfectly happy to apply all kinds of pressure to the British to make this result happen. But then Behrensdorf reveals, through some diplomatic back and forth, Behrensdorf reveals that this isn't the case. And so the issue is really of the leverage against the Allies. The Americans have it. But they only want to use it if they can be confident that the peace they're going to force the Allies into is a peace that's a real compromise, a peace without victory. And they don't want to force the Allies into a circumstance in which the Allies are accepting what is at root a German victory, even if a kind of moderate one, because they don't believe, Wilson in particular doesn't believe, that anything other than a peace without victory, a real compromise, is going to result in a kind of durable peace that will last the test of time.
Was there ever, in fact, regardless of what Gray, McKenna, Asquith, and Balfour thought, a parliamentary majority in favor of a compromise peace in the period that the book deals with?
Yes. So that's a really interesting question, because I mean, Parliament is important here. It's an actor that has to be taken into consideration. But at the same time, it's not as though the diplomacy that the government gets up to is going to be subject to a direct parliamentary vote. It's not as though this will be submitted to the House of Commons for its approval. The question, the power of the House of Commons is really one of blowing up the government, of a vote of no confidence that would blow up the government. So really the political question is about holding the government together in such a way that would hold that kind of threat at bay. And this of course would be a very delicate political thicket, to be sure. I am in no way understating the delicacy of such a problem. But at the same time, the importance of Parliament should not necessarily be overestimated in terms of how this diplomacy would play out.
Would it be true to say that for you that perhaps one of the chief points of the book is an anti-teleological one, that contingency in history matters a great deal?
Yes. I mean, I think contingency in history does matter a great deal. That there's a lot of moments in the book where things, could happen very differently, or where things are just very chaotic. One thing, especially when it comes to British foreign policy in this period, is that British foreign policy is chaos. That there are all kinds of different people doing all kinds of different things and competing with one another. In such a situation, contingency is of course going to be very important because it's going to determine, who wins which debates at what point and whether the winners of those debates at which, at those particular points go on to have various other consequences. I think contingency is very important. There are these structural factors that we have to take into account that set up the situation and how the situation could turn out. But in a lot of ways, foreign policy actors really have the hands, have a great deal of agency and a great deal of ability to shape how events turn out. And so there's a lot of contingency in terms of how that agency gets used.
Following from that, would it be true to say that the events of the first 4 months of 1917 almost make it seem as if it indeed, quote, God was an Englishman, unquote?
To an extent. Britain certainly gets very lucky. Part of it is not just luck. Part of it is the policies of Asquith and of his followers within the government trying to extend this American lifeline for as long as possible. But it's true that the Americans come into the war almost at precisely the moment where British assets in the United States are about to be exhausted, and that these British supplies that Germany tries to cut off, that the whole point of the unrestricted submarine warfare that ultimately brings the United States into the war is to cut off these supplies. And so the race is really in some ways between those in the British government who understand the importance of extending the life of these supplies for as long as possible by conserving British assets in America, and those in Germany who understand the threat the United States poses to the German war effort. And so Britain gets extremely lucky in that that the United States enters the war just before a potentially war-ending financial crisis. Yes.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
I think it would be the lesson about contingency and about the extent to which people have more control over situations than sometimes people realize. That But there's a tendency sometimes to view international events and international outcomes as, you know, being in the hands of these swirling forces that are beyond mortal control, that history is somehow predestined to play out in certain ways, and that I would say no, that people shape history, and people get to make and people get to and have to make decisions that shape how history is going to turn out, and so I'd say it's one of human control over events, and that this human control should not be underestimated.
On that observation, which I would like to agree with entirely, I would like to thank you very much, Dr. Larson, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Dr. Larson.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.